Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 25th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the Hobby Lobby case, which is the HHS contraceptive mandate case argued earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from two experts today. Both of them were in the oral argument today. I'm going to give very brief introductions so we can get right to the substance. They're going to give opening remarks of 6 to 10 minutes each, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and then, as always, we'll be asking for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions. We're going to hear first from Ms. Adele Keim. She's counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberties here in Washington, D.C., and then she'll be followed by Professor Robert A. Destro. He is the professor of law and the director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Law and Religion at the Catholic University of America Columbus School of Law. And with that, Ms. Keim, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Sure. So today the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Hobby Lobby versus Sebelius. This case was consolidated. There are two families before the court. One, the Green family, evangelical Christians. The second, the Hans, Mennonite believers from central Pennsylvania. They both have closely held family businesses, S-corps for the tax lawyers on the line, and they both have a longstanding faith-based objection to offering that small subset of contraceptives that may cause early abortions, things like the so-called emergency contraceptive Plan B, Ella, and certain kinds of IUDs. They don't object, the Green family, for example, don't object to the birth control pill. They've always offered that in their health plan. They continue to offer it in their health plan, but they do object to these emergency contraceptives. So Paul Clement argued for the Greens and the Hans. This was a 73rd argument before the court, and General Verley argued for the government. So a couple of high-level comments. First, for those who have been playing along at home and reading the media coverage or perhaps saw some video footage of the protests outside the court this morning, the most noticeable thing to me was what was not discussed at oral argument. And that is any kind of broad constitutional level interest in ensuring women's equality. That just, it never came out of the government's mouth. It was not raised by the justices themselves. The sort of broader issues of women's equality, although they were touched on in some of the briefing below, just really did not make an appearance at this argument. Second thing that was really absent was any discussion of any kind of access problem. The government didn't argue before the court, and none of the justices raised the argument that there is some kind of crisis of access to contraceptives or access to these emergency contraceptives in this country. Access issues just, again, weren't touched on. You know, that's a sense in which the arguments were kind of a contrast with some of the public discourse, which has raised those issues a little bit more. But what was there? Well, the argument was bookended with parades of horribles as the justices tried to feel out the limits of both sides' positions. So the argument began with a series of questions from Justice Sotomayor right off the bat, just seconds into Mr. Clement's argument, from Justice Sotomayor, and then joined by Justice Kagan. And they asked Mr. Clement, what are the limits to your argument? Would your position that for-profit businesses, at least closely held family businesses like these, can bring Religious Freedom Restoration Act claims, would that allow a business whose owners objected to immunization to bring a claim? What about owners who objected to blood transfusions? Now, there's been a lot of back and forth on examples like that. Blood transfusions, for example, to my knowledge, Jehovah's Witnesses who might object to blood transfusions for themselves don't think that that's an obligation that prevents them from paying for blood transfusions for others. They think it's a personal religious obligation for them. They don't think it extends to non-JWs, okay? But what Clement focused on, the immunization hypo, and what he said was, look, in that case, the government might have different counterarguments. They might be able to point to herd immunity and other concerns like that that would give them a genuine compelling interest and would make that the least restrictive means of achieving those interests. But that's not this case. That answer was exactly right because it forced the court to go back to RFRA and what RFRA requires. RFRA is a 1993 law, civil rights law, that protects the free exercise of religion. When you show that, when a person shows that their free exercise of religion is being substantially burdened by the government, then the ball shifts to the government's court. They have to meet the strict scrutiny test, compelling interest, least restrictive means, familiar to everybody on the line. So, but what Ocentro, which is a unanimous 2009 Supreme Court case interpreting and applying RFRA, said was RFRA requires courts to look at the meaning of giving an exemption to the person who is standing before the judge, who is standing in the courtroom and saying, please exempt me. You cannot use a parade of horribles and the possibility of further claims down the road to deny a reasonable and justified exemption for the person who's standing before you. So Paul Clement was able to kind of push back against that side of the parade of horribles. But I said there was another parade, and that parade went on the march at the end of the argument when General Verrilli was standing before the court. And that parade came from was brought up by Justice Breyer, Justice Alito. They said, look, there are examples, Justice Alito pointed out, in Europe there have been moves to ban kosher and halal slaughter on animal cruelty grounds in several countries in Europe. What about a kosher butcher or halal butcher in this country? If we ever enacted a law that said, because of animal cruelty concerns, animals must be stunned before slaughter, which is prohibited, of course, by kosher and halal rules, would those businesses and would their owners be able to bring a RFRA claim? And General Verrilli didn't really have a good answer for that. He said, well, that might be targeting a la Lukumi. And Justice Kennedy said, well, okay, well, let's take out the targeting element. Would they be able to bring a claim? And he hemmed and he hawed and he finally said, you know, their customers might have a claim. And this troubled Justice Breyer. He said, are you telling me, okay, you're saying that five kosher butchers, if they decide to incorporate, they can't have the protection of religious liberty? And that seemed to be the government's position in that case, which leads to the second float in this parade of horribles, which is this one. What about a medical practice that's incorporated? Could the government pass a law requiring doctors who were in part of an incorporated medical practice to provide abortions upon demand, even if their religiously informed conscience forbids them from doing so? And there again, General Verrilli really had no good answer. And he basically said, well, current federal law provides conscience protections in that context. And when he was pressed by the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy to say, well, yes, but what if that law was taken away? Doesn't your position mean that they wouldn't even be able to get into court to challenge the burden on a law like that? He really didn't have a strong answer for that. So the horribles were definitely on display, and the court is clearly looking for a way to limit the arguments being put forth by both sides.
Professor Dashkrow?
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, thanks to everybody for joining us, and thanks, Adele, for the great run-up on this. I'm going to take a look at this from a slightly different angle. I think that I'm going to focus a little bit more on the government's argument. I think that there was an extensive conversation of the government's basic position, which is there really isn't any burden here. And there was an extended discussion of how much would this really cost Hobby Lobby and Conestoga. They were using Hobby Lobby, obviously. It's the bigger company. And so they have 13,000 people, and Justice Kagan wanted to know. She said, well, look, if you don't you could drop everybody and just pay the, you know, just pay the tax. And that's probably less than the $26 million, you know, that you pay, that you pay in the penalty, you know, in the taxes. But you're, so you're probably paying more already for your health insurance than you would be paying if you dropped everybody. And there was a, you know, and so the question, they were really trying to make the argument that there really isn't any burden here. And I didn't, I don't think it was really going anywhere with the conservative justices. And there was an extended discussion of what's the nature of that burden. Now, to the extent the government's next fallback position was, to the extent that there is a burden, it's a justifiable one. It's justifiable because women need birth control, and Congress granted them a statutory entitlement to essential services. And the government placed very heavy reliance on United States versus Lee, you know, in which there were religious objections to the payment of Social Security taxes. And so basically they said, they went back to this whole idea. There was some laughter in the courtroom where they were talking about, you know, is this really a tax? Is it a penalty? I mean, what is it? But this, they went back and said, well, look, this is, if you have to pay the tax, you know, what's your objection? You can't, you know, you don't have a free exercise objection to paying taxes, and all this is a tax. And if you let people out of this tax, the practical result of the requested accommodation by Hobby Lobby and Conestoga is that you will deny women a statutory entitlement. And if you, and they said that we don't see any cases where you've been allowed to claim a religious exemption from that kind of a law. And in fact, the government argued that doing so externalizes the cost of the accommodation and forces third parties to bear it. And in that view, you know, is a violation of the Establishment Clause, basically saying the female workers, you know, now have to pay their own bills, you know, and that violates the Establishment Clause because their employers won't pay for it. Now, you know, in terms of the demonstrators out in front who Adele had mentioned, you know, one of the signs they had and some of the T-shirts they had on said, you know, not the boss's business. You know, and of course, you know, for those of us who are more sympathetic with Hobby Lobby and Conestoga, you say, yeah, that's exactly right. Why is any of this the boss's business? You know, and if you want to really make a privacy argument here, then why are you asking them to pay? And that really is the underlying, one of the underlying questions here. And now in terms of the legal arguments that were made, you know, one of the more fascinating aspects of this case for me was the interplay between the constitutional arguments and the statutory arguments. Justice Kennedy kicked that part of the argument off early when he asked the question, is this a statutory case or is it a constitutional case? Now, clearly RFRA is the controlling statute, but the question came up pretty early and Justice Kagan raised it. Well, what does RFRA actually require? Did it suggest that you were just restoring what the law was before Employment Division versus Smith, you know, with all of its warts and all of its vagaries, you know, or, you know, was it, is it a new legal standard? And this is where Justice Scalia jumped in and said, well, look, you know, it's a new standard. Congress wrote provisions, the compelling state interest standard, the no less burdensome alternative standard. He said that's new in RFRA. And so we have to deal with the statute that Congress wrote. And so, you know, what you can see in the more, you know, liberal of the justices, you know, they're very concerned about this Establishment Clause question, about the externalization of costs. And then there was, but to also to underscore the notion of that this is a statutory case, as Adele pointed out, there was an extensive discussion later in the argument about the about statutory conscience clauses and how you read the statutes together with RFRA. and the fact that Congress has written statutory exemptions, you know, when it is 1 to 2. And so the question is, well, was RFRA really even necessary? Now, of course, and you see this in the case, because RFRA clearly, under the pre-Smith cases, you know, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga, you know, at best, you know, would have had a hard time. You know, I think that they would have pretty clearly have lost in the pre-RFRA days. And there is the other piece of this was a question that Justice Kennedy raised. And I have to say, it took me a little bit by surprise. And he asked a question, I don't have the transcript in front of me right this minute, but he asked a question, something to the effect, what kind of a government do we live in? He says, did HHS write the regulation in a manner to comply with RFRA or not? Because he says, if it doesn't comply with RFRA, you know, where are you getting the authority to draw the distinctions between churches on the one hand, religious nonprofits on the other, and then everybody else? You know, and you could see that that was really, you know, where they drew these lines and where they got the authority to draw the lines is a very important kind of sub rosa argument that's taking place deep underneath that surface, and it then kind of boils to the surface, at least in my view, it boils to the surface when you get into the constitutional or statutory, I think it's really a statutory discussion today, of does a for-profit corporation have any rights under RFRA or even under the Free Exercise Clause? And Adele covered that pretty well, so I will close out my arguments here and leave the floor open to questions.
Terrific. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one caller on the with a question at this point. We've got over 200 people on the line, so I know there are more questions than that. You need to indicate your questions by pushing star and then pound on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Well, hi, this is Richard Dorflinger. The others are probably hesitating because they don't want to ask stupid questions, but that's never stopped me.
Go right ahead.
I'm about 80% through the transcript now. It's my impression that, just as overall, Paul Clement did a very good job of responding on point to questions, and that the Solicitor General seemed more embattled at times. I was wondering about your general feel for how this case is going. Of course, many people say that Anthony Kennedy is the swing vote. Maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. Are you picking up any signals from the way the argument went in general that change any predictions about who's likely to prevail?
Well, let me start. I think Hobby Lobby and Conestoga win maybe 7-2, as many as 7-2 on the for-profit corporation question. I don't think that Kagan was at all convinced by the government's answers on those. And I think that the question is whether they would get Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg on that. I tend to doubt maybe that they would. I think that they win probably 5-4. At best 6-3, but maybe 5-4 on the RFRA question. And the question is going to be I think that the justices who do not want them to win are going to try and make this as narrow a decision as possible.
Adele Keim, do you have anything on this point?
No, I mean, you could. There were tough questions being asked from both sides. You could tell the predictable directions that the tough questions were coming from at some points. But at some points, there were tough questions coming from, you know, for General Verrilli from Justice Breyer, and you know, at some point, you know, Paul Clement was fielding tough questions from Justice Kennedy. So you saw the entire court's very engaged, you know. Which we already know they're engaged with all their cases, but they're very engaged on this case, and so that's about all I would want to say at this point. Although I certainly hope that Professor Destro's prognostications prove to be true.
Well, once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open right now. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. I have been advised by staff here that we've had some technical difficulties with our telephone conference call provider, so I apologize for that and pledge to try and get a transcript or a tape of today's event online as soon as possible. But today, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Matt McReynolds in Sacramento, California. My question is, to what extent the justices' questioning today reflected their awareness of all the other dozens of cases making their way up through the system on the same issue involving religious colleges and a host of other entities?
So it's definitely clear they were aware of at least one nonprofit mandate challenge, and that's the Little Sisters of the Poor. We know that because the justices raised the Little Sisters at least two or three times during the argument. And the Little Sisters, of course, they're a Beckett Fund client, but they went up to the Supreme Court on an emergency application on New Year's Eve this last year and were granted temporary relief by Justice Sonia Sotomayor and then eventually a more lasting injunction pending appeal by the entire court. So with that background, it's clear that the court has these cases in the pipeline in view. It's got a couple of cert petitions even before it on some of the nonprofit HHS mandate cases. And they were aware, too, that of who was before them and that there were other people with different claims, for-profit entities with different claims. There were repeated comments. You know, the Hans and the Green family, they only object to four out of well, the Greens only object to four out of 16 contraceptives. Only those that have the potential to take a human life. They don't object to contraceptives per se. They cover the pill. The Greens have always covered the pill. They still cover the pill. So the justices made a couple of times there was the comment made to Mr. Clement that, you know, we know that you really picked the best clients here. You really have the best clients before us here.
They did,
but there are
yeah.
other, but there are other people who have broader exemptions. I think, you know, I don't know what you think, Professor Destro. I thought Paul's response was spot on. Well, these clients didn't pick. You know, I didn't pick these clients. These are real people with real heartfelt religious objections and with real family businesses that are about to be crushed by fines. So, yeah, the justices clearly knew that the ruling in this case is going to reverberate throughout the whole universe of these HHS mandate challenges.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that other than you could see it came, their awareness came out not only in the discussion of the for-profit, not-for-profit, religious church distinction, but it also came out in some questions by Justice Ginsburg about, well, what about people who don't want to cover any contraceptives? You know, and what about, and then those were the kind of the cascading parade of horribles. What about vaccinations? What about, you know, blood transfusions? I mean, it's a, you know, they see this, it's kind of, this is a major case. Everybody on the court, I think, sees it as such.
If I could ask one more follow-up question, was there any mention at all made today of the successor statute to RFRA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act?
Yes, quite a bit, actually, and the, I mean, that's what I made the comment that you really do as you look at this as a statutory case. You know, you have to, especially when the conscience clauses came up, you know, you're looking at the entire web of federal conscience protection here. And to the extent that that the court really does the heavy lift on interpreting all these statutes together, you know, it seems pretty clear that there are statutory protections here. You know, how you get out of them, I think, is why the government made the argument that they did, which is we really don't think there's a burden here. And if there is a burden, then, you know, you're violating the Establishment Clause if you give them an exemption.
We've got three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Kathleen Hunker from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I was looking through the administration's pleadings and their position on how the Green family surrendered their right to organize their business around religious principles the moment they accepted tax and liability benefits. And to me, that seems to parallel the court's train of cases on unconstitutional conditions, where the government can't deny someone a benefit simply because they wish to exercise a constitutional right. And I was wondering if you saw the parallel or if there was a kind of any fertile ground for that type of argument to be brought forth.
I think that's a really interesting argument. The court didn't go to the unconstitutional conditions place during the argument today, but there was some dissatisfaction, I think it's safe to say, on the court with the idea that incorporation automatically deprives you of your ability to bring a free exercise claim under the First Amendment or RFRA. And I think you saw that from Justice Breyer when he noted, you know, hey, we can have five kosher butchers, and then under the government's view, when they decide to incorporate, which almost all businesses do, then all of a sudden they lose that religious liberty. You know, I think there's some palpable dissatisfaction. I don't think I was overreading that. I don't know what you think, Professor Destro, but, there's some dissatisfaction with that idea that incorporation is so widespread. That would somehow deprive you of religious exercise. And of course, I mean, let's be clear, as Mr. Clement pointed out today, that many, many, many churches are incorporated. And many of the court's kind of landmark cases involving free exercise rights involve the rights of incorporated churches. There's nothing inherent in the corporate form that keeps you from exercising religion. So the government's got to draw a line that's narrower than that. They've chosen to kind of draw it between for-profit and non-profit, although they backed a little bit away from that at this argument in a way that was a little bit surprising. But I think there's some. I think that your dissatisfaction is shared.
Yes, I think that actually your argument, it's actually a very good one. It was made and rejected, unfortunately, when the court decided Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which they then overturned in Citizens United. You know, but Justice Scalia picked up on the point somewhat. He did it in a slightly different way than you did when they were talking about, well, you know, you could see the parade of horribles saying, well, what if GM came in and they had a religious objection to having seatbelts? I mean, I'm making up the example, but that was the genre of the question. And Justice Scalia pulled them back to state corporate law. He says, look, what corporations have the right to do and the rights of minority shareholders are governed by state law. You know, we just leave that to state law. Yeah, which is a very consistent Justice Scalia theme. So in that regard, the question of, you know, it was discussed in Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, why is it that when you adopt the corporate form, you just give up these rights? And you know, as you can see in Citizens United, the court rejected that eventually. So I think Citizens United is kind of the answer to your constitutional conditions case.
Thank you.
A reminder that if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, this is Tony Kolink, Florida Coastal School of Law. Two quick questions. One is, was Citizens United discussed at all during the argument? And two, is there any indication that any of the justices think they should treat this as a free exercise case instead of a RFRA case?
So Citizens United was not discussed to my recollection at all. It just didn't come up, which is interesting. It wasn't a major theme of the briefs before the court. And then there was a little bit of mention of the free exercise, the constitutional claims. But I agree with Professor Destro's earlier remarks. Many of the justices seem to view this as a statutory case. And that was more or less the way it was argued, with the exception of one kind of short colloquy.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Citizens United did not come up at all, and I think that Justice Kagan, when she started, when she raised the question, what does RFRA really do? I mean, you could almost see her as being a little, I'm reading into this now, this is my opinion, saying, well, if we really go back to pre-RFRA, then this becomes an easier case for us, because, we do what Justice O'Connor said in Smith, which is, it's our job to strike sensible balances, and that is precisely what Scalia's majority opinion in Smith didn't like, is that the court's not supposed to strike sensible balances, and this is why RFRA was written the way it was, which is to say, no, the government's got to bear the burden of showing, no less burdensome alternative here. So I think there are people who'd like to go back to the old way, but they're stuck with RFRA. So I think we're going to be seeing a narrowly written RFRA decision.
Thank you.
Next caller.
This is Ed Menino in Philadelphia. I thought the best argument that the government had was the parade of horribles for what corporation, whether it be Exxon or General Motors, could deny vaccines or whatever. And I thought in that context, there was a very interesting suggestion by Chief Justice Roberts. It appears on page 52 of the transcript. And he said, well, look, we have two closely held corporations in this case. Why don't we decide the issue relating to them and defer the question of whether GM and Exxon and people like that, corporations like that, have any rights? And he went on to say, which I thought was very interesting, I don't think that's going to happen, namely that you're not going to see large corporations because of unions and, just the outpouring of antagonism that would happen in a large public corporation. So it seems to me there's a good chance that what this court may do, if Chief Justice Roberts' suggestion is followed, is just decide about closely held corporations, not decide the broader question of whether all corporations have these rights, and wait for a case which will never come when GM and Exxon try to do something like that. I'd like to have the comments of the two commentators on whether they think that might happen.
Who wants to respond first? Professor?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen for precisely the reasons why Justice Scalia made the point about corporations being creatures of state law, is that there's an internal dynamic to a corporation. And we see this in particular, one of the major developments in the same-sex marriage context was that a lot of big publicly traded corporations became very gay friendly, and so the culture of the corporate culture, I think that they would get hammered by the media if they did this, and so even if Conestoga and Hobby Lobby win, you're not going to see AT&T say, oh, okay, all of a sudden we have religious objections to vaccinations, I really don't see it as being a realistic fear in the context of a major publicly traded corporation because of the cross pressures within corporations.
Let's take another question.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I did not have a chance to read the transcript, but I was just wondering if there was any questioning that covered just a couple of points. One, with respect to contraception, what illnesses are actually prevented by using contraception? Pregnancy is not really an illness, so I was wondering if anyone addressed that. And secondly, could Congress pass a law, say a bacon mandate for delis, and then if a Jewish deli decided they didn't want to serve pork, could they possibly be sued as well? So thank you very much. I'll take your answers.
Sure. So taking the second question first, I think that was part of the parade of horribles that was, you know, that the justices focused on when they were questioning General Verrilli, which is, you know, what happens to a kosher deli when faced with a mandate to a federal law that requires it to violate the religious conscience of its owners? What happens to halal slaughterhouses and other, you know, businesses where we recognize that the owners have strong religious convictions that affect the day-to-day operation of their businesses? I think those were tough questions for the government, and they really didn't have good arguments or good responses. So yeah, on the broader issue of contraceptives, that just didn't come up very much, and that was one of the kind of the glaring absences that I noticed. The way these arguments are not being perfectly reflected in the press coverage. You know, the Greens cover the pill. They cover contraceptives as most Americans think of contraceptives. They just don't cover these four drugs and devices that, you know, may result in the death of a human embryo. So kind of any overall debate about the utility or function of contraceptives generally just doesn't have a big place in this case with these claimants. And that's a key thing. Look, RFRA requires you, and we know this from Ocentra, which was, you know, the unanimous 2009 case interpreting RFRA. RFRA requires you to consider whether you can make an exemption for the person that is standing before the court. You don't get to say, if I make an exemption for you, I have to make an exemption for everybody, so no exemptions. You don't get to use what, you know, Chief Justice Roberts called that, you know, that bureaucrat's logic. You have to say, will exempting this religious claimant standing in front of me right now, this church that wants to drink the hallucinogenic tea, giving them an exemption, as in Ocentro, or these businesses that want an exemption for these four drugs, is that going to break the bank? Is that going to break the system? Is there no way to accommodate this, these religious claimants? So that was what was before the court here. So there was no broad discussion at all of kind of the contraceptives generally.
Right. In fact, the more important discussion came at the very end when they were discussing whether or not these were really abortifacients. And the government denies that they are. And basically they said, look, you know, the IUD, you know, which is, you know, more expensive up front, you know, most people don't consider that to be an abortifacient. You know, and that's then what transitioned into a series of questions about could you force a for-profit corporation to pay for abortions? You know, that's what led into that question. The same question with respect to the second question that the caller asked about. You know, they got into the discussion about the kosher deli or the halal deli, and raised the question about what's going on in Denmark. You know, where basically people say, well, look, this is prevention of cruelty to animals, and the question did come up. Well, what would happen if the government said, you know, look, this is a public accommodation, you have to be open on Saturdays? You know, these are the kinds of questions that the government's argument eventually leads to if you're not careful. I think that even some of the liberal justices were concerned about that.
We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And once again, I'll announce we apparently had some experience some technical difficulties with people joining the call. So we are going to try and put the full recording of this call on our website as soon as possible, no later than tomorrow morning. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Larry Joseph in Washington. I read that Justice Kennedy indicated this should come from Congress, not the agency, and one of the presenters here called this a statutory case, maybe both. I'm wondering if it's not a regulatory case, and there's sort of two principles of our government that come into play, the separation of powers as between, you know, executive and Congress, and also federalism, because I sort of see this in part as a preemption case where not Congress, but the agency has preempted all of the state preventive care regimes, some of which maybe cover pregnancy and most of which don't. And I'm concerned about that angle. And I guess I know, like I said, I haven't read the transcript, but I saw that Kennedy at least was concerned about the Congress versus the agency. Was there any federalism issue that came up other than this corporate state law?
Not really. I mean, I don't remember any. Do you at all?
No, the corporate state law. But I will say, taking what you noted about Justice Kennedy, that was he repeatedly pressed the government and said, look, you have not argued. So the government, backing up, the background of these laws is that the government has created a religious exemption for churches and an accommodation for religious hospitals and colleges and other religious charities. But nothing for religious business owners. Okay, so Kennedy seemed genuinely troubled by that on kind of administrative law grounds. He said, look, you don't admit, because the government hasn't admitted that they have to, under RFRA, exempt churches and create this accommodation for religious nonprofits. So Kennedy pressed them and said, so how did you exercise your judgment, HHS, to create these exemptions and accommodations for some religious groups if you don't think that they were compelled by RFRA? And almost at one point kind of raised the issue, I know there's not a non-delegation claim here, but why is the agency crafting these narrow exemptions and then taking a stand and saying we don't have to even pay attention to RFRA? RFRA doesn't even apply here. We get to say, we get to pick who the religious exemptees are and who's in and who's out of our accommodation. And he seemed very troubled by the fact that the agency was taking that upon themselves and felt that it was completely unconstrained by an actual statute that Congress passed. So I think that was probably the closest it came. What do you think, Professor?
You know, I think that's exactly right. I think that's why when he said, and again, I don't have the transcript immediately in front of me on that page, but he said, what kind of government do we have when an agency can you know, is kind of unmoored by the statute? And if it's not governed by RFRA, what is it governed by? And the only thing that General Verrilli could say in response is agency discretion. Now, you could hear like Chevron bells going off, you know, but that assumes that the statute gives them that discretion. And that's why I thought that the overarching statutory discussion, not simply RFRA, but the other conscience provisions, you know, and then the text of PPACA itself and the text of RFRA, I mean, you know, you're going to see some pretty heavy lifting being done on statutory interpretation, I think, in this case. But that I sat up straight in my chair when I heard Justice Kennedy ask that question, because that was one I hadn't even thought of.
We've got three questions pending now and a few minutes left. Let's take another call.
Hello, this is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelsohn out in Denver. Thanks so much for your comments so far. I was curious what your opinion was on how to determine whether a corporation is religious or is exercising religion. I know that Hobby Lobby is closed on Sunday, and in Conestoga, there were some indications of religion. Do you think we need a corporate charter that talks about religious practices, or another way to figure out whether a corporation really genuinely is religious or exercising religion, other than what the owners purport to believe or purport to need to do in order to vindicate their religious beliefs?
You know, I'm not sure that that makes that much difference. If you go back, you know, a little further in the free exercise and establishment lore to cases like NLRB versus Catholic Bishop of Chicago, what you find is that it, you know, to the regulator, you know, it's like you're not religious enough to avoid the, you know, you're too religious to avoid the, you know, you're too religious for us to accommodate you, because then we'd be violating the Establishment Clause, but then you're not religious enough to qualify for an exemption under the Free Exercise Clause. That discussion was happening today. You know, and so that discussion has not gone away. So when you look down the road at cases coming in the pipeline, I mean, there's no question, for example, that the Little Sisters of the Poor are a religious organization. But then you get to religious universities like the one I teach at, you know, and there's always a big discussion. It does go back even to the public funding cases of, you know, in order to get funding, you have to be sufficiently secular. So the question that kind of was lurking, and I believe that both Justice Alito and Justice Scalia raised it, is, are you trying to get secular answers to questions that are inherently religious? You know, who is the government to really decide what's religious? You also see General Verrilli's argument that he was inviting the court to draw distinctions among the clauses of the First Amendment. You know, well, it's okay for a for-profit corporation like ABC or the New York Times to make money and have First Amendment rights, but the Free Exercise Clause is somehow different. You know, and it's constrained by the Establishment Clause. So, I mean, there's a lot of historical background in that question, but I think that the oral arguments today, you know, if, you know, and I've advised a number of religious organizations, I think they should have as much as they can in their charter, you know, but they need to live by it. And of course, they always run into the problem of, if you're too religious, then you run into, you're not allowed to participate in public programs. So, you know, the whole question of equal access then comes up in these cases. So I'm not sure. I think that, you know, the oral arguments today showed that people that are not churches, or that are not so religious as the Little Sisters of the Poor, meaning a hospital, you know, Conestoga Wood Products, you know, and or even a something where they don't close on Sunday, Chick-fil-A. I mean, they close on Sunday, but you know, but the when you look at these cases, I think the whole point of it would be to get a little bit of clarity so that they can breathe a little easier, rather than have the regulators say what's mine is mine and what's yours is negotiable. And I think that's what we heard today.
Well, you know, it is interesting. Corporate charters didn't come up at all. There was no mention of, you know, because, and that's interesting because the government tried to make an issue of that earlier in the litigation. I mean, they pulled the incorporation documents from Hobby Lobby and they said, aha, it says it's incorporated for all lawful purposes. And of course, Hobby Lobby said, yes. And last time we checked, you know, pursuing religious goals was also lawful. And, you know, by the way, the Attorney General of Oklahoma happens to agree. So that's helpful, because under Oklahoma corporate law, both nonprofits and for-profits can incorporate under the same general incorporation statute. So, you know, and religious nonprofits can incorporate under that, the same statute that Hobby Lobby used. So that discussion over kind of what's in your charter, how do you determine religious identity, which corporations are religious enough, that's something the government tried to raise at earlier stages of the case, but it really wasn't an issue for the justices. And I think the way that their questions indicated they were looking at it was that this is a sincerity issue. This goes to sincerity. There didn't seem to be any. There were no questions about kind of, do you have to establish some kind of separate religious identity for your company before you can start making free exercise claims, which, by the way, there's a company in this case, Mardell Christian Books, which is owned by the Green family. It was started by David Green's son, that, you know, has Christian in its name, so it has a kind of a public religious identity and religious mission of selling Christian books. But there was no kind of appetite on the court for saying you had to have that separate kind of identity if you were going to bring a free exercise claim. The justices seemed to kind of accept the idea that what you had to show was that there was a sincere religious exercise. And so then there was some conversation about how do you show sincerity? Is that a real test that courts can meaningfully apply? And how do you judge sincerity in a situation where maybe not all the family members agree, or there are shareholders who don't agree on what the on religion? But Justice Scalia had the simplest, perhaps the most effective pushback for that was, hey, courts determine who has control of corporations all the time. It's just a question of control. Whoever controls the corporation, determines what the party, what the party is able to believe. So that was the closest I think the court came to approaching the issue that you've raised.
We've got a couple questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Carissa Mulder. I was calling with two questions. My first one was about Justice Ginsburg's question about, well, I know that you only don't want to cover these four possible abortifacients, but what about the next guy down the road who doesn't want to cover contraceptives? And my question there is, if that is a question that the court takes seriously, doesn't that put the court in the awkward position of making a theological judgment between whose religious beliefs are really correct? And wouldn't that sort of fly in the face of Thompson versus Review Board and the general thought that it's only sincerity and the court doesn't judge whether it's reasonable? And I wondered if that was something that you guys thought would come up. And then secondly, I was wondering how you thought the justices, assuming they rule in Hobby Lobby's favor, would try to limit the reach of the ruling.
Well, certainly the question came up. Justice Ginsburg raised the question, so did others, about the other kinds of contraceptives. That's why I think the discussion of Ocentro was so important, because, you know, is this really a religious burden? If it is, you know, you could say, and this is the way the old-fashioned free exercise cases would have come out pre-Smith, is they would strike a sensible balance. They said, well, look, you know, you guys are only against these four kind of abortifacients, but if we start making exceptions for people who are opposed to all contraceptives, then that's not a sensible balance. That's not what the standard is in RFRA, you know. But there's a direct parallel to it in the pre-Smith draft law cases, where, you know, the Catholics came in and said, well, what if we're opposed to all unjust wars? Well, you know, that you lose. And this is the problem that the Little Sisters of the Poor would have if you start saying it's not a question of sincerity. Is this really your belief? Is it a reasonable belief? And what's the government's compelling interest in forcing you to violate it? And that's where we didn't get much of a discussion in this case about what the compelling interest is, other than you're going to be denying women a statutory entitlement. You know, they didn't get into that balancing question, you know, but that was that whole parade of horribles was really about, the next cases in the pipeline. So I know that answers one of your questions.
Yeah, and Professor Dester, I think I might take a little bit of issue there. I know Justice Kagan was trying to really kind of put a wide gulf between pre-Smith free exercise jurisprudence and RFRA, or kind of say that RFRA should reflect this pre-Smith free exercise jurisprudence, and it's not consistent with the arguments that the parties were making here. She kind of said, look, strict scrutiny pre-Smith was not really very strict in these free exercise cases.
Right, right.
you know, and I would gently push back on that, and I would say, you know, there actually would be, I mean, I think that Lee would still probably come out the same way. I think that, the Social Security tax and Lee could probably meet strict scrutiny, even the Ocentra robust,
right,
you know, very few exemptions, strict scrutiny. I'm not so sure about Bronfeld, but, I mean, Bronfeld was, you know, 45 years ago, strict scrutiny didn't exist for anything in the way that we understand it now at that point, you know, in the history of the courts. Jurisprudence. I would press back kind of gently there, and I disagree with Justice Kagan's kind of analysis there. But what I would say, Carissa, is in this situation, so yes, number one, RFRA requires you to look at each claimant on their own merits. The government might have different arguments to make in a case where the full complement of contraceptives are objected to. But you know what? We handle some of those cases. I've litigated some of those cases. We represent the Little Sisters of the Poor. And you know what? The government has not done anything. They have introduced the same extremely thin administrative record in both the cases like Hobby Lobby and Conestoga, where there are only four contraceptives objected to, and in the cases where the full complement of contraceptive coverage is objected to. They've kind of rested on their hands. They have not shown that there's any kind of significant access problem. They have not shown that there is no less restrictive alternative. They've really fallen down on that. And they have, you know, they can't contest that they have exempted, you know, large group employer plans covering something like 30% of all American workers that have, you know, employer-based health insurance, don't have to offer any contraceptive coverage whatsoever because of the grandfathering exemption. So I think in this particular context, in this litigation, we know what they would say to people who object to the full complement because we've seen what they've said, and it's a very thin evidentiary record. It's nothing like the robust evidentiary record that was present that the government developed in Ocentro. And that's one of the reasons that these cases are so difficult for the government. They have not done the basic nuts and bolts litigation work to build their record and build their foundation. So by the time they hit compelling interest and least restrictive means, where they might theoretically be able to introduce some arguments about why, you know, and drive a wedge between the Conestogas and Hobby Lobbies of the world and the Little Sisters of the Poor, they just haven't done that basic nuts and bolts litigation work, at least on the preliminary injunction stage, which is where all of these cases are.
Thank you.
Let's try and be quick here, and we'll see if we can squeeze in a final question.
Oh, this is Rich Dorflinger of the Bishops Conference. I apologize for double dipping, but my other question was this. There was some discussion of the fact that these companies can just stop offering health insurance altogether, with, I thought, a great insouciance, because as Mr. Clement tried to say, these companies see that as part of their religious mission to their employees as well, as provide good health care. Certainly that would be true of all the Catholic plaintiffs in the cases down the road. But then they got into a discussion about, would it then be a substantial burden? All you have to pay is $2,000 per employee, and Mr. Clement pointed out that, yeah, that would be on top of the extra wages they'd have to pay to try to keep employees at all, and so on. But I wonder how it affects the government's compelling interest case, because they're saying basically these employers, and only the employer, is the effective way to get women these contraceptives, but they're claiming there isn't any great interest in having them provide anything else, that the government's interest would be served if they drop health insurance altogether and throw people on the mercies of the government that claims it doesn't know how to provide an equally effective way to get contraceptives to women. Is there a contradiction here in the case that there's a compelling interest in providing contraceptives but nothing else?
The short answer to that is yes, there's a contradiction.
And Justice and the Chief Justice pointed it out. So when you look at the transcript, you'll see that he points it out. He says, how can it be possible, for example, that it's not going to cost the health insurance company or the Little Sisters of the Poor anything, but it's going to cost the government a lot if it picks up the slack? I mean, there were some really interesting economic discussions going on in that oral argument, but you have to read the transcript to see it.
Well, I think we're going to have to let that be our final word and wait for a decision in this case. My thanks today to Professor Bob Destro and Adele Keim. We're very thankful for your spending the afternoon with us here today, and of course for attending oral argument this morning. To our audience, thank you for your participation, and thanks for dialing into our call. Again, I apologize for any technical difficulties some of you might have experienced, and pledge again that if you check back on our website, we will try and post the full record of this proceeding as soon as possible. And please do check our website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.